government regains the trust of its citizens is by telling the truth. There is no other way, no shortcut.
I call upon our government to open up like the Belgians have, the French have, Brazilians have, the Argentines, the Mexicans have all released their files. It's about time now that we do the same thing and become a part of this planetary community.
It is way past time for all of us to know what our own government knows, instead of being kept in the dark by a policy of denial.
The last time that Congress held a hearing addressing the extraterrestrial issue was 1968, 44 years of sightings ago. In those 4.5 decades, hundreds of thousands of new sightings have taken place. Government agency witnesses have come forward. Media coverage has expanded. Hundreds of documentaries have been produced. Thousands of books have been written. And yet the United States Congress has remained silent. So for a period of 5 days, at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C., 2 blocks from the White House, 12 blocks from the Congress of the United States, we're going to conduct a citizen hearing on disclosure of an extraterrestrial presence engaging the human race. 40 to 50 witnesses of high rank and station, from military, from agencies, possibly from intelligence services, along with the top researchers in the world, will give 30 hours of testimony to 5 former members of the United States Congress.
So maybe the citizens hearing has a chance to try to leverage open some of the truth about the fact that we're not alone in this universe, that we might actually begin to look at what we really are, what the true history of this planet is, and that might be what gets us into a future without self-destruction.
The motto of the citizen hearing is, if Congress won't do its job, the people will.
Greetings, everybody. Welcome to Galactic Roundtable, Countdown to Disclosure. I'm so glad to have you back here today. Each broadcast, we've been looking at one of the witnesses from the citizens' hearing, which will be April 29th to May 3rd in Washington, D.C. And today we're going to look at Jim Pensington. We're going to take a deep look into the Rendlesham Forest case, which is it's the UK's Roswell. And it happened in 1980. And frankly, when I look at more of this information, I know in the United States where if we hear Rendlesham or if we hear Bentwaters, we kind of, unless you're an expert and you're deeply steeped in all these cases, we don't have as much knowledge about this one as others. And when you look at the testimony from this one from 1980, there's so many people that came forward and tried to debunk it that it's laughable. It's got many layers and levels, and it's kind of an exciting case. So I'm looking forward to that today. I want to share a few updates first, and later in the program, a surprise. I want to mention the White House petition that we have out. This morning, there's 1,667 signatures. The whole point of the petition, which was started on March 23rd, was to raise consciousness, to get the media to have something to comment on. And with a lot of signatures, we can get that accomplished. 1,600 signatures isn't that much, and I don't know how much good it's doing. You can see if you go on, if you've been on the newspapers over the weekend, the only thing you're going to see is war, 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 war. The gender program is that we're going to have another war. They'd really like to see that, some people, I think. The ones that I'm thinking about today are the high schoolers in South Korea. You know, in South Korea, every child is required to go through 2 years of military commitment because, according to the South Koreans, they've never ended that war. And what happens is they can take the young person at, when they finish high school, take them right into the armed forces, and they have to serve their 2 years. And whenever they take someone, they make sure that they pluck them away from their home and take them a few hours away. So they don't let them serve locally. They pull them away from their families. And it's a mandatory service. Or they could go off to college, and in the middle of college, they would be notified that they have to pull them out of college for their mandatory service. So maybe have 2 years of college, then go off to the army and, you know, serve on the border, do the border patrol for 2 years, and then come back to college. You cannot find a high schooler in South Korea who you could tell that this was nonsense and this is never going to happen, because they wouldn't believe you. They've been living with this their whole life. So let's think about all the ones in that area, especially the children, and send them love. The next thing I want to tell you about is that I created a new website over the weekend. The website name is galacticroundtable.co. If you have trouble finding that, you can go to galacticroundtable.org and click on the picture, and I'll take you right there. And on the new website, this is a global initiative to contact friendly extraterrestrials and ask for world peace. The Keshi Foundation, on April 21st in Brescia, Italy, is holding their World Peace Treaty Conference. And Dr. Keshi will speak that day. And everyone can go in and sign the World Treaty for Peace. And this idea, my concept, takes us one step further. And I'm asking that we reach out to our extraterrestrial brothers and sisters, letting them know that we're looking for world peace. And I got this idea from watching a videotape with Dr. Stephen Greer. He was explaining how he has technology where he can call in the ships. And he has created an Android and iPhone app to help folks make contact. And I put that information on this new website. And about 4 or 5 times a year, he takes a group of about 20 people out to make physical contact. And there's a videotape on there of him explaining how he does that. And I'm saying on this website that I can teach anybody to make etheric and physical contact. And I'm offering classes. And there's a description of the classes and what someone would experience if they took the classes. And a lot of people might criticize that and say, well, this is a big promotional ad that she's putting out there so she can make some money. Well, that's not really true. The classes are for folks who have a genuine desire to learn how to do this. I can teach you. I can have you make contact. The concept is for those who read everything and review it and say to themselves, I can't afford that. I can't afford the classes. It still plants a seed in their minds, and they'll start thinking about contacting ET for world peace. And that many of them will even say to themselves, I can do that. I can do that. I already do that. And that's what I want. I wrote the website to raise awareness, not to sell classes. I'm not in this for the money. Obviously, I wouldn't be doing it like this. keep your eyes to the skies, everybody, and think about that. Make contact from your heart. They will hear you, and it will make a difference. I hope you'll explore this website. It's about 10 pages. It has a little bit of information on each page. And I don't think I'm going to be changing it up much. I'm just going to be leaving it there. So please read through it and enjoy it. Okay, so let's go on to our Rendlesham case. Let me see. Jim Pensington, U.S. Air Force, retired. He will be one of the witnesses at the citizens' hearing. James Pensington entered the Air Force in 1973 and served over 20 years active duty in the U.S. Air Force. He was assigned to the Strategic Air Command Elite Guard in Omaha, Nebraska, providing security for general officers, congressmen, heads of states, and the president and members of the cabinet. Key assignments throughout the world followed, including service in Desert Shield and Desert Storm. He wrote defense, security, counterterrorism, and contingency plans for the U.S. Air Force and NATO. James served 10 and a half years overseas. Also, he provided security for Air Force One and other classified aircraft weapon systems. He also held, for the majority of his 20-year career, a U.S. top secret and a NATO top secret cosmic autonomous security clearance. The people who know what that is know what I said, but I don't. They have different levels and they can look into different things. The most notable assignment began in July 1980. He was assigned as a security police supervisor at RAF Bentwaters, England, a twin base with the RAF Woodbridge. Together, they amassed the largest tactical fighter wing in the U.S. Air Force. On the night of December 26, 1980, Sergeant Pensington was the security police supervisor for all security forces at RAF Woodbridge. Sergeant Pensington led the investigation of a craft of unknown origin, which had landed and subsequently took off after an on-ground investigation, which lasted more than 45 minutes. Okay, so this Rendlesham Forest case thing happened. I'm not an expert, so hopefully I'm not saying this wrong. I think it happened over two nights, or maybe it was three nights. I think 25, 26, 27. I think it happened over three nights. And that's why there's so many mess-ups in the report. We were listening to Nick Pope, who was explaining to us everything that went wrong in the report. He had opened it as a cold case and looked into it, and he described what he had seen from a neutral position. And it was very interesting, and I started looking into Jim Pensington's case, another witness, and thought, wow, we haven't even covered this. So that's why what we're doing today. I love this story. Jim Pensington, we're going to listen to a series of videos. They're short. They're shorter. But you won't have the full picture unless you look at all of them. Jim Pensington was one who was there. The reason why there's three nights in a row is because the craft returned. This NATO facility held nuclear weapons in bunkers under the ground. And on one night, the craft was beaming lights into the bunkers through the ground. The part that Jim Pensington played a part in was when the craft landed, he was right there and he put his hands up to it. And when he did, he received a download in his mind telepathically, which turned out to be binary code. It was series of zeros and ones, like 001, 00011. And when he went back home, the zeros and ones were running through his brain and he couldn't shut it off. And it didn't matter if he slept or ate or what he did. He couldn't stop thinking about zeros and ones. So he grabbed a notebook and he started writing. And I forgot what he said. There was a dozen or more pages of zeros and ones in a specific sequence that he remembered exactly the sequence they're supposed to be in. And he wrote it in a notebook and threw it aside, but he kept it. And years later, they looked it up and it did have meaning. So that's only part of his contribution to this story. He also went back and got physical evidence that a ship had landed. It left imprints on the earth. And there was a 19-year-old who was involved in this case back then. And he leaked this to the British press. Otherwise, we would have never known about this. He was upset because of the way they were handling things, but he was just a kid back then. And so he had the motives of a kid. I mean, if we all had the idealism that we held when we were 19 years old, this would probably be a much, much, much better planet. So I think that part of it's really cool. And there's four or five major players in this story. So let's dive into this now and see what we can find out. The reason I'm playing this video first is because this part of it is not mentioned in the rest of what I want to show you today. This is the part when he's explaining about the binary code. It's pretty short, but it's very interesting. It was one of those cases where the ship had landed and they could see the hieroglyphs on the side of the ship, and then his hands touched the ship, and as soon as he touched the ship, he got this download. Remember when Linda Moulton Howe brought that video, that 1986 video of the biochemist who had visited the extraterrestrial in the cold hydrogen environment? The doctor had said there were parts of his skin that were like sheath that he could pull back, and when he pulled them back, there was like a slimy kind of mucousy surface and some what looked like suction cups, and he could, that the being would touch his hand to the ship, to the to a part of the spacecraft, and then it would interact with it electromagnetically with its thoughts. It's pretty cool stuff. Here we go.
The download that happened, of download or transfer of information that happened when you touched the symbols, was it like a telepathic download? I mean, do you have any conscious memory of it? How it?
Oh, it absolutely was telepathic. It wasn't like I could see it in front of me, like visually. It was like it was a pictorial that was running a movie in my brain. You know, it was a mind's eye kind of thing. I couldn't physically actually see something though. And it was flashings of zeros and ones. And later we find out it's some type of binary code, which be honest with you, I have trouble with algebra, or I'm not a math person by no means, let alone computers. And in 1980, I don't think we even had computers that we used, so it was foreign. Anyway, I did record the glyphs at the scene, but when I went home in the following day, I can't get these images. I mean, they're just like there, ones and zeros, 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 zeros. They're all in my head. So I felt compelled to write them out. So I grabbed my notebook, flipped it open, and then I did the most crazy thing I thought in the world. I wrote these ones and zeros all the way down to like 12, 14 pages of them. And anyway, at a certain point, when I got done, I had no more imaging. Now, I'm not at the craft. I'm at home. I go back to Ipswich, and this is where this is happening. And then once I'd done it, though, the imaging was gone. So I thought, great. Now, can I tell somebody that I went and received imaging in my living room at home in Ipswich, and I had to write them down, and I'm okay now. I did not tell anybody that happened, okay?
I've never seen a notebook before, and that was one of my questions to him, because there's a different date, you know, than the one. Well, it makes sense now, because...
Okay, the person who's talking now is John Burroughs, and he was a policeman, a military policeman, who was also out there that night. And I think they're friends. They're in the same interview together.
The way it is the 27th is when he wrote the codes out.
December 27th, 1980. Remember what you were doing in 1980? Remember 1980? They had all those... Every other film out was something about the Cold War. You know, Seagal or one of those guys were going to go blow up something that was a Cold War thing. You know, we were all paranoid back then. That was the Reagan years. Imagine what these guys went through discovering this.
You know, we wrote down what was bugging him. But the before that was all the other stuff that he wrote down. But he said right there when he was talking, he goes, I had it down. Mm-hmm. And that's the first time I had heard it, and the first time Linda had heard it. A download. What do you mean by a download? He goes, well, I felt like something was downloaded to me. And I think maybe he said he felt like something maybe you'd come. But he says it was downloaded to me, and then it drove me so crazy, I had to sit down and write them down. And we're like, write them where? And he goes, right here in the notebook, because he brought it for me to look at, because I had questions. And he opens up the notebook, and he goes, these numbers. He goes, I have no idea what these are and what they mean. And it was a binary code. And I mean, I'm sitting there like, what the hell is going on? And she goes, binary codes. And I go, what are binary codes? And she goes, that's a way of communication. And I'm like, what? You know, and she goes, no, if it's legit, she goes, it's not legit to be wrote down. But if there was really a download, they'll mean something. And now I'm like, going, what the hell is going on?
I love that story. Let me bring up this. This is a special that was aired on TV. It's very good. This is Jim Pensington. This is Jim Pensington and John Burroughs. And this was from a TV series from back then. I forgot the name of it. You'll recognize it if you're old enough. Here you go.
In 20 years, a handful of U.S. Air Force personnel have been haunted by an event that took place in the Rendlesham Forest, just outside their base in Suffolk, England. They maintain that for two nights in 1980, they experienced, up close, an encounter with an unidentified craft. Their accounts make the Rendlesham incident one of the most detailed and well-documented to date. These witnesses also say that the government launched an investigation and then tried to cover it up. This event has an eerie similarity to a sighting nearly 33 years earlier, when an extraterrestrial spacecraft allegedly crashed near a military base in Roswell, New Mexico. Both stories involve eyewitness accounts from respected officers, government investigations, and classified records and evidence.
This really was the Holy Grail. This was certainly Britain's most famous UFO case.
There's no doubt about it. This is Britain's Roswell.
Yeah, you may move a little bit this way. It's coming this way. It's definitely coming this way.
What really happened in the woods outside the Woodbridge Bentwaters Air Base in December 1980?
If you contact the Pentagon about what happened December 1980 at RAF Woodbridge, England, they're going to tell you right now nothing happened there.
People need to step up to the plate and say something.
It happened, and it was real, and someone else visited Rendlesham Forest in 1980.
This is Bentwaters Royal Air Force Base. Located 70 miles northeast of London, the now dormant site was once a highly sophisticated military installation.
The main function of the twin bases there was to support the NATO effort in case of a war in Europe. We would go ahead and mobilize our A-10 aircraft to support whatever war effort we were told to do.
In 1980, with Cold War tensions near their peak, Bentwaters and nearby Woodbridge air bases are operated by about 12,000 U.S. Air Force personnel, making it one of the largest NATO complexes in all of Europe. But the site, bordered by the dense Rendlesham Forest, has a secret. This was Bentwaters' weapons storage area. Exactly what was kept here is officially classified. But researchers and observers agree that a massive nuclear arsenal was stockpiled beneath these concrete bunkers.
The extraordinarily secured underground bunkers with alternating layers of steel, concrete, earth, steel, concrete, earth, held something like 300,000 kilotons of nuclear ordnance.
The American airmen who man this base are highly skilled. They're trained to deal with life and death situations with a cool, clear head. And that makes the events at Rendlesham even more mysterious, because what they saw on Christmas night 1980 made these thick-skinned military men shudder with fear. It's 3 a.m. Airman John Burroughs is patrolling the east gate of Woodbridge Air Base, part of his normal routine as a security policeman.
Security did the airfields, weapon storage areas, and stuff like that. He controlled the entry of the base.
The 20-year-old has been with the Air Force for almost 2 years and has been stationed at Bentwaters for about a year and a half. Tonight, there is nothing to observe but the stars overhead.
It was cold that night. It was a clear night, pretty much. You know, it was a clear night. There's a little bit of fog.
As he's walking, his superior, Bud Stevens, pulls up in a truck.
He tracked me down and said, let's ride around for a while.
The men drive into Rendlesham Forest. Suddenly, Sergeant Stevens notices a strange light in the woods just off the road.
He said, whoa, is that normal? And I looked out and it was just a weird glow in the woods. He said, no, it's not normal.
Burroughs can't shake a bad feeling.
You know, he just felt a real sense of danger or something wasn't right. There were different colored lights, you know, like you see on a Christmas display, different colored lights that were blinking on and off.
Alarmed, the men speed back to the gate to call the flight desk from a secure phone line. They do not want to broadcast the information over their radios. At Burroughs' insistence, the call is transferred to the base's Central Security Control, or CSC. The shift commander dispatches 26-year-old Sergeant Jim Peniston to the site. Peniston has been a security policeman with the Air Force for 7 years.
They told me I need to go out the east gate. We have a situation out there. I said, what type of situation? He said, well, I'd rather have the on-scene patrolman tell you what that is. I says, well, can I wait? No, you got to get out immediately.
Within minutes, Peniston and his driver arrive at the east gate. Burroughs and Stevens direct his attention to the woods.
I seen this multicolor, yellow, red, just about, you know, 200-300 meters away. And it looked like an aircraft crash immediately. That's the color that you get from titanium and fuel burning.
Peniston calls back to CSC and gets clearance to investigate a possible downed aircraft.
If it is an aircraft crash, we can go ahead and, render assistance and set up security for it.
As part of standard procedure, Sergeant Peniston tries to gather information from Bud Stevens.
And I said, well, do you hear a crash? But he said, no, it didn't crash. It landed.
Stevens is too frightened to help with the investigation. He returns to his post while Burroughs and Peniston proceed without him. Soon after, they speed off with a driver and head toward the mysterious light. When they can no longer maneuver the vehicle around the dense trees, Burroughs and Peniston proceed on foot. They walk about 50 meters and notice strong interference on their radios.
The farther we got into the woods, it became more and more intermediate, where it was harder and harder to talk to them.
Suddenly, Sergeant Peniston feels an electrical charge in the air.
I've been in excitable situations before on duty, and I know the adrenaline feeling, but this here was different. You feel it on your clothes, your face, your hair.
The closer they move toward the light, the less the scene resembles a crash.
It had no smell of smoke, and it was too contained. It was just like one ball out there.
We came into a clearing, and then that's when it was like a bright light lit up the whole area. It was almost blinding.
Sergeant Peniston moves within 10 feet of the object, and the bright light dims. As his eyes adjust, he has trouble understanding what he's seeing.
I'm a rational person. I want a rational explanation of what was going on. I could not come up with one.
Peniston snaps pictures with his military-issued camera.
The craft was triangular in shape and measured probably 9 feet wide by about 8 feet high. I couldn't tell the front or back to it. I mean, there was no engines on one side or no cockpit or nothing like that. It was all completely smooth, the outside of the craft.
He then circles the object, writing descriptions in a notepad. These are the notes he wrote that night.
Surface is unknown. identity unknown. No apparent landing gear present. No sound but appears to be operating somehow.
Peniston's handwriting changes dramatically as he gets closer to the craft.
I was really having problems with the type of craft. I keep saying this. I have a problem with understanding what I'm recording here.
When he draws near enough, he reaches out and touches the object.
The fabric of the craft was smooth, like glass. It was warm to the touch, but not hot. There wasn't like lights on it. There somehow it was in the fabric of the craft.
On the front side of the object, Peniston notices several strange symbols. He copies them in his notebook as well.
They were like markings, not numbers, not language. There were several, maybe six symbols, measuring 3 feet wide. I wasn't trained for what I was experiencing.
Suddenly, the object emits a blinding flash. For more than 20 years, a handful of U.S. Air Force personnel have been blinding flash of light. The men take cover.
Then the object, whatever it was, lifted up, went up, and then moved back away over the trees.
The speed of the craft leaving the area was, the best way to describe it is probably in a blink of an eye. I've never seen any craft move that fast in my entire Air Force career, and I don't think I ever will again.
As the men slowly rise to their feet, their attention is drawn by another flash of light through the trees. At first, they assume it is the craft, but on second glance, they realize it is the Orford Ness Lighthouse, 5 miles away. Burroughs and Peniston check their radios. They're working again. It is now around 5 a.m., roughly 2 hours since they first spotted the mysterious lights in the woods. They contact the CSC, and their commander orders them to rendezvous with a security team back at the East Gate.
So we were like, what are we going to say? Well, you know, we can't explain what we saw. We can't explain what just happened.
Later that morning, the men are brought in for debriefing. Peniston is reluctant to divulge everything he witnessed.
It was not a good career move to report exactly what we've seen. I went into the shift commander's office with Burroughs, and we gave a sanitized briefing of what happened that night.
After the debriefing, Peniston says the shift commander issues him a thinly veiled warning.
Gentlemen, he says, Project Blue Book ended in 1969, and sometimes things are best left alone.
Project Blue Book was the code name for the U.S. Air Force's controversial UFO investigation unit.
During the course of our investigation,
before it was disbanded, its goal was to determine if UFOs were a potential threat to national security. Despite his commander's warning, Sergeant Peniston can't put the strange encounter out of his mind.
I got back to my house and I couldn't go to sleep. I'd probably sat around the house for maybe 2 or 3 hours. And finally I said, well, I got to go back out there.
He returns to the site with some plaster of Paris. His plan? To make casts of any indentations left by the craft.
I wasn't going to leave there until I had answers. I wanted something tangible.
He spots 3 round impressions in a symmetrical pattern on the ground. They are a few inches deep and roughly 10 feet apart.
They measure exactly the same distance apart, each of the pods, approximately 2 to 3 inches thick.
These are the casts made by Peniston the morning after his sighting. He believes they show the marks left by the craft when it landed on the forest floor. He decides not to show them to his superiors. Along with his notes and roll of film, the sergeant now has the 3 plaster molds to help back up his story. But Peniston's physical evidence doesn't solve the mystery of Rendlesham. Just 2 nights later, the UFO returns. And this time, the deputy base commander makes a chilling record of his own encounter.
Now I'm observing what appears to be a beam coming down to the ground.
Late December 1980, sightings of a mysterious craft at the Woodbridge Bentwaters NATO complex in Suffolk, England, have put many airmen on edge. The strange encounters began the night of the 25th, when airmen reported seeing unusual lights. By the early morning hours of the 26th, two men claimed to have come within a few feet of a landed craft in the neighboring forest. It's now the evening of the 27th. 40-year-old Deputy Base Commander Lieutenant Colonel Charles Holt attends a holiday party at the Officers' Club. His celebration is cut short when one of his men arrives looking distressed.
He showed up just white as a sheet. And he wasn't the type of person to get too excited too easily. He was a former Marine. He said, "It's back." We looked at each other and said, "What's back?" He said, "The UFO."
After two nights of disturbing stories, Holt decides to investigate for himself.
The police were spending more time looking in the sky than they were at the airplanes they were supposed to be protecting. It's time to put this to rest.
Holt instructs a three-man security team to assemble their gear and meet him at his quarters. Within minutes, they head toward the Rendlesham Forest. By the time Holt arrives, a security cordon has been established around the perimeter of the woods. Holt is briefed on the situation and is told that the UFO is no longer visible, but the men are experiencing mysterious outages in their high-powered floodlights called lightalls. Holt and his team collect their gear, a still camera, a Geiger counter for measuring radiation, and a night vision device called a starscope.
I took my small personal cassette recorder, which I carry just about everywhere with me, just to record the events.
The team heads into the dark woods.
And I was going to investigate and show that there was definitely a good, reasonable explanation for everything.
The following is the recording Holt made that night.
150 feet.
Along with the malfunctioning lightalls, Holt's team encounters the same radio interference experienced by Burroughs and Peniston two nights prior. They are walking through the area where Burroughs and Peniston reported seeing the unidentified craft when Holt notices gashes in the bark of several trees. It looks as if they have been struck by a large object. Holt orders one of his men to take photographs.
He took pictures of the indentations of the trees and everything. He was taking snap, snap, snap all the time.
The Geiger counter begins registering high levels of radiation, but only in the areas surrounding the alleged landing site.
There's any rings on the tree you're taking samples from on the side facing the suspected landing site?
Four clicks back.
Up to four. Interesting. That's right. We're taking the sample now.
Four.
That's the strongest point on the tree?
Yes, sir. Have you got to the back? There's no place whatsoever.
Suddenly, the dark woods are alive with sound.
We're getting very strange sounds out of the farmers burning our animals. They seem to be very, very active, making a lot of noise.
All the animals in the forest were acting up, making a lot of noise, and the barnyard animals from the farm, which was on the adjacent side of the particular location, were also acting up.
One of his men points out a glowing light in the distance.
The trees.
With his tape recorder rolling, Holt documents every moment of this encounter.
You just saw a light out there. Where?
Right at this position here, stir the head from between the trees. There it is again.
We saw this bright red glowing object. It looked like an eye. It's the best way I can describe it. It was bright red, had a dark center, and appeared like as though it were winking.
We're about 150 to 200 yards from the site. Everyone else is just deathly calm. There's no doubt about it. There's some type of strange flashing red light in here. Still, I saw young attention at two. Weird. It appears that you may be moving a little bit this way. It's brighter than it has been. You know, it's coming this way. It is definitely coming.
moving through the trees horizontally, but also traveling vertically. In other words, it was zigzagging through the trees and dripping what appeared to be, best way I can describe it, as molten metal.
Holt and his men pursue the object into a nearby field.
As we approached, it receded. It went away from us. It went out into the farmer's field. It stayed there for probably 20, 30 seconds, maybe a little more. And then it silently exploded and broke into multiple white objects. So we went into the field and searched around on the ground looking for burnt marks or evidence of whatever was coming off the object.
The men find nothing in the field. Overhead, the object makes a sudden turn.
It approaches at very, very high speed.
Okay, here he comes from the south. He's coming toward us now.
It stopped overhead and sent out a beam. The best way I can describe it is like a laser beam.
Now I'm showing what appears to be a beam coming down to the ground. Turn around.
It was a steady, constant beam as far as the diameter. It fell at our feet, and we all just went in awe. And I thought, was it trying to signal? Is it trying to warn us? Is it threatening us? And just as suddenly as it appeared, the light went click, was off.
The object speeds away. The team watches, mesmerized, as it moves over the base and continues to beam lights to the ground. To some, it appears that the light is beaming directly into the base's weapon storage area, where nuclear missiles are reportedly housed.
There's one object still over the Woodbridge base at about 5 to 10 degrees off the horizon. Still moving erratic of several lights and beaming down some barrier.
At this point, Holt's recorder runs out of tape. A craft is still hovering in the distance, but Holt and his team aren't sure what to do next. There's no protocol for what they've just encountered. Unnerved and exhausted, the men head back to base. Airman John Burroughs, who had witnessed a UFO two nights earlier, arrives at the site, along with Sergeant Adrian Bustinza. Burroughs is immediately concerned by the behavior of the men returning from the field.
They were kind of, I don't know, they were weird. I mean, they were upset.
After a brief conversation, Burroughs spots a blue light glowing in the same clearing Holt has just examined. The airman is determined to investigate further.
I was bugging him, come on, Colonel, let me go out and see. I mean, I want to see what it is. So he finally authorized myself and Stenza to go forward to get a closer look.
The men head toward the strange blue glow in the field. Adrenaline quickly takes over, and Burroughs breaks into a run.
As I was getting close to whatever it was, all of a sudden it was gone.
The field is thrown into darkness, leaving the airmen scared and confounded.
This was gone, and I'm standing out in the field, and there's nothing.
Burroughs turns to Bustinza in disbelief.
He goes, what happened to you? And I go, I don't know what you're talking about. He goes, you were, like, involved in the lights. He said, you were just, like, it's like all of a sudden you were there, and then you were in the lights, and you were gone.
Burroughs and Bustinza return to base. Burroughs' second encounter with the bizarre lights leaves him with nothing but questions. They are unaware that a sweeping investigation involving covert government agencies is already underway. The men claim that as they headed back to the base that night, they were walking into a government conspiracy. January 1981. Rumors are swirling around the Woodbridge Bentwaters air bases in eastern England after mysterious UFOs are sighted by the U.S. Air Force personnel stationed there.
Many of them were some years into their tour of duty. These were highly trained witnesses. It's not as if they'd all just turned up there the night before.
The military investigation that followed remains controversial to this day. Those who say they witnessed the UFOs believe the military was more interested in damage control than in finding the truth.
What our government did in the name of secrecy to these individuals is absolutely shameful.
Okay, there's more, but it doesn't add to our knowledge about the case. So this happened on Christmas night, 1980, and then the craft came back two nights later on the 27th. After that, these guys, when they came back to the base, they were injected in the neck with sodium pentothal, and they were they probably had some fake memories implanted, trying to confuse them and pull out the memories from that night. And then it goes more deeply into that other, the British soldier who leaked the story to the UK newspaper, and what followed after that. There are other videotapes out there with these high-ranking military dudes, and they come on and they say nothing ever happened there, and they're so funny. Oh boy. I want to finish up today with just a short presentation. I hope I have this brought up at the right place. This is Daryl Anka speaking. Daryl is the channel for Bashar, and he's talking about consciousness. So I'd like to just share this for a few minutes, and then we'll do a meditation together.
Everybody go, oh, shift the frequency. I mean, I used to.
Okay, these are two guys on the radio, and they are interviewing Daryl, and their program is called Cutting Edge Consciousness. And Daryl's going to be telling us clues about how we can, well, let me let him say it.
In the past, at the level of that frequency, try to.
I might have to call this up again. Let's see.
Level, and then watching things line up vis-a-vis our ability to do that. Again, for me, you know, at some point, you guys nailed it, that at some point it was a leap of faith, and now it's more of understanding that as things are showing up, to the degree I'm really willing to look at them and recognize what's being expressed as a frequency, I have the ability to go, oh, shift the frequency. I mean, I used to in the past, at the level of that frequency, try to clean up all the all the stuff that was going on. And in some ways, you know, I could muddle through to where maybe I shifted frequency unbeknownst to me, or some leap of faith occurred and things started to clean up. But again, this level of the doorman, the observer, the ability to go, wow, okay, what's the frequency? And more important perhaps is shifting the frequency. So our state of being is going to start being reflected back in different experiences.
Changing the pitch.
Changing the pitch.
And the key to changing that pitch is to discover and make conscious what the definition or belief is that's generating that particular frequency. Because only when you identify the actual definition that generates the frequency does it then become possible to change that definition and thus change the frequency.
So, Daryl, let's move the conversation to the end zone. So now we can expect some calls. And letters.
That's right. And comments.
There is a lot of enthusiasm around ideas of attraction and laws of attraction, and many of our friends are leaders in that conversation. And yet there really is nothing to attract, because there's nothing outside of ourselves. It
right.
is more accurately, as we're talking now, as I'm understanding you, it is more accurately a recognition of the pitch that we are at as the culminating soup of a variety of elements, including belief, as you said, and thought and choice and decision and action and feeling. It is the self-managing of that in order from the inside out to change the pitch, to lift the pitch or to drop the pitch if we so wish. And that experience is really a signal to ourselves that we experience in this waking lucid dream.
I'm getting a signal.
So we're not really.
I'm getting a signal. I'm getting a signal.
We got to go for a break. When we come back from the break, we're going to pick this up and talk about whether we're really attracting or transmuting. But first, we are going to transmute to these words from our loyal sponsors.
Welcome back to Cutting Edge Consciousness, thought-provoking discussions and bold ideas from the edge of possibility.
Thank you so much for staying with us on Cutting Edge Consciousness. So, Daryl, back to you. We want you to unpack a little bit about this distinction about, is it really a matter of attracting anything from the outside to us, or is it more accurately a recognition of the pitch that we are operating on and from the inside out transmuting our experience?
I believe the latter, mechanistically speaking, although the experience of attracting things is how we interpret the idea in physical reality.
Beautiful.
But manifestation isn't really the idea of attracting something from the outside to us that isn't here, because there really is no outside per se, even though we experience the idea as if there is. Manifestation is really shifting the frequency to the point where what is already here but invisible becomes visible to us suddenly, and thus appears before us to our senses, but didn't really come from anywhere. It's been here all along. We just didn't perceive it because we weren't on the same frequency level as it.
So we experience an outside currently, most of us do anyway. We experience an inner and outer, we experience a duality, but it's clear that the direction of integration and the direction of the grand work of the moving of consciousness is the collapse of that, and that we begin to perceive and conceive of a veil dropping between the inner and the outer, that there is only one thing going on.
Yes, and I'd actually like to interject something else here on another level that in my channeling Bashar has talked about, and I'll use the word attract here just for a moment for convenience sake. But the whole idea of the law of attraction, again, isn't so much the idea of, it is true in a sense you have to be on a certain frequency to, quote-unquote, attract a certain thing. But I think what people also don't remember or don't realize is that we are always exhibiting or always radiating a core frequency. We may wrap it in other frequencies, we may disguise it, but we are always radiating that core frequency.
You mean like a signature frequency?
A signature vibration that is uniquely our true selves.
And that's called essence sometimes, right? The essence.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah, you can call it by any number of things.
Right. I call it Freeman.
It's the same thing, yeah. But the idea really is that anything that is truly representative of that vibration, and I'm just going to speak about this sort of euphemistically, is already doing its best to try and get to us, to try and manifest.
Oh, that's so good.
If it doesn't manifest, it's because we're keeping it away with a contrary frequency. It's not so much that we have to be a frequency that attracts it. It's that we have to just relax into the frequency that's already commensurate with that manifestation. The only reason we're not experiencing it is because we have beliefs and definitions and frequencies that are actually keeping it at bay. And conversely, anything that is not our frequency, again, just sort of poetically speaking, is doing its best to try and get away from us. But the only reason the things that are not us stay around is because we hold on to them with beliefs. So it's not so much an issue of trying to attract or trying, in a sense, to push things away. It's an idea of letting in and letting go.
That's fantastic. And this element of determining the belief that's generating a particular experience. In other words, there is this way that we become very intimate with the frequencies that are, you know, habituated and or hand-me-downs. I mean, hand-me-down is a bit of a misnomer because they're ours. I mean, you know, however we got them, we signed up for it in some way. Mm-hmm. But the my sense is the very frequency of that way of relating in and of itself generates something. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yes, of course. It makes a difference. When you know it's possible to change a belief, that in and of itself makes it easier to change a belief.
Yes.
So at some point, the understanding of the prism by which we broke down our unity with the more of ourselves, the prism by which we splintered ourselves into an experience of separation for the sake of the experience. There comes a point when we are sufficiently and we are aware enough of the mechanism that there is even more mileage and traction to be gained out of developing relationships with the higher frequencies, integrated frequencies of the real self, the truer self. That is the joyride.
That's fascinating because this goes back to what you said earlier, Darryl, which is the relationship with the synchronicities. Because otherwise, I mean, a lot of us get caught in this mechanistic, we understand it mechanistically, but
we like the cause and effect
trip. Yeah, but if we're coming at it that way, that is a frequency, creates a whole nother game, as it were.
Yeah. Yeah, every belief has a self-reinforcing frequency. So whatever you believe to be true, whatever you believe is possible or probable, brings with it more of that frequency, more probability, so to speak. If you believe things are less likely, then it brings that frequency and prevents you from even knowing that something else is possible.
And I'm talking really about softening the edges, which is, again, the frequency of the response. In simple terms, things like compassion. For me, compassion is an opening frequency. So to the degree I have compassion for something, it eases and it becomes, I think what you were saying, the easing in, then we're just playing with the synchronicities. We're like, oh, it becomes more fun. That's my sense.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's pretty triggering when you start lining up one synchronicity, another coincidence, and then have one bang, 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 three, four in a day. It takes a very, very present. You have to be very present with yourself, or I'll speak personally. I have to be very present with myself to handle that much joy and that much non-linear kinking in my love affair with the straight line.
Yeah, I think that's actually the bottom line for most people, is the question of how much ecstasy can you believe you can handle.
Wow.
You really are an ecstatic being. That's true.
And we have a fit.
Okay, I'm going to stop it there because it's getting late. It's a really good video. I'll load that up on Galactic Roundtable so you can take a look at it. It's about 48 minutes long, the whole thing. Think about what they just said. How much ecstasy can you handle? Take a minute and look at the flip side of the coin. Can you align your frequency with what you want to experience? When people say they stay in meditation for hours every day, it's because many times sometimes they mean they're sitting in the chair meditating. I've done that. I've stayed in meditation 3, 4, 5, 6 hours a day, sitting in a chair in meditation. In those times, I was, you know, going out of body and visiting places and having experiences. There's many different types of meditation. So that's why I have us meditate at the end of this program for people who have no experience with meditation, or even if they do, they like to have 3 minutes in a day where someone gives them a guided meditation. It's a nice refresher. Another way of staying in meditation is constantly focusing your frequency on what you want to experience. So maybe you want to do some experiments with this and think of something you've been really wanting to experience that would make you so happy, and see if you can get your energy to align with that energy and become that reality. If you are allowing your ego to drive your every move and the choices you make, which have you do certain actions during your day, you know, scan the internet, scan the blogs, look for the right channeling, read the news, all that jazz. Instead of spending time with your family, instead of making memories, instead of being outside in nature, it's still snowing here, by the way, everybody, if you're keeping track. It's gloomy and it's raining and snowing. Anyways, everything's a choice. How you spend your time is a choice. And if you're doing these things that are stuck in a rut, you're not going to have a chance in the world of aligning your energies with something that's ecstatic. So it's a meditation that takes a great deal of focus and discipline. And it's more effective as a practice, if around the times that you're not meditating, you're doing something for others, you're dedicating your life to others, you're making your plans for new earth, you're doing physical feats that carry you into the plan for new earth, you're devoting part of your day to service for others. That might be your boss, that might be your family, it could be anything, but somehow you're serving the greatest good. When you do those things, which have a higher vibration, it'll be easier to keep this meditation of raising your frequency to what makes you ecstatic of what you want to experience. It wants to come to you. But if you're keeping your energies really low, sitting in the bar talking to friends about ET coming, it's not going to happen. If you keep your frequency really high, you align with that which makes you ecstatic and you become it. Let's finish this with a meditation. We've done this one before. It's short and sweet. It's very sweet. Before we begin meditation, I'd like you to bring into your consciousness those things in our world that we would like to send love to and help them along their way as they transmute out of our environment. For example, the mass media, which is corporate owned, feeding us nothing but war every day and with made up stories. We all know that Kim Jong-un isn't making this stuff up and making these pronouncements. He's just the man behind the curtain. There's a whole, I don't know what you want to call them, group of folks living in North Korea who've spent their lives in the Cold War they've written his script. It's all make-believe stuff. Same thing in Iran, same thing in Israel. Bring these concepts into your consciousness, wrap them in a pink bubble and watch them float to outer space as they leave our reality. And we know we're in the fifth dimension and none of these things are true. And imagine, coming in 30 years into an old closet or an old storage space and finding a TV and a VCR and an old tape, and you put it in and you remember that we used to have these things, but we don't have them anymore. Let's jump into the future. So then after you consider these things, move into this meditation and just release them. Let me get set up for this. All right, everybody, thank you. This is a guided meditation, and it's called Heart Light. There is a simple exercise for radiating light and love into your environment. Prepare a tall, plain, white, lighted candle and place it before you. You can imagine this in your mind, everybody. Now make yourself comfortable sitting in front of this candle with your back and neck in straight alignment. Let your body relax and breathe slowly and evenly for some time. Now gaze steadily at the flame. You may blink your eyes as is comfortable. Just continue to gaze at the flame. See the wick, the center of the flame, and notice how its aura spills out and around. If your mind wanders, gently bring it back to the focus of the candle. After a while, close your eyes and visualize the flame and its aura in the center of your chest. Its radiance spilling out beyond the confines of your body. You may wish to send this soothing, healing light to someone who is troubled, afraid, or sick, or others. Just visualize the light of your heart surrounding that person or situation, accompanied by your loving thoughts. Remain in this state for as long as feels comfortable. Through practice, you can develop this ability to shine, creating a healing and soothing effect on your environment by your own positive energy. Do you ever have the urge to improve the world and don't know how? By becoming this flame, this constant positive energy field, you will do the greatest service to the world, to your family and friends, and to yourself. Once you are able to visualize the candle's flame without the candle actually standing in front of you, you can incorporate projecting its light while you are in deep relaxation. That's the end of the meditation, everybody. So I want to draw your attention back to making contact with friendly extraterrestrials for world peace. Go into your mind and imagine how you would do that and think about it. I had read this channel from Ashtar, from Catherine, and it had said that we should look at a website called Transitions, and that on this website, Transitions, it was saying all these people who were doing projects for their local community and bringing in New Earth. And I read it and I was thinking, I don't really want to do anything like that. I couldn't think of anything locally I wanted to do. And I realized after a few days of meditating on it that really my calling is outside the local. And this is a result of that contemplation. So there's a lot of information on this new website. It may stir some new thoughts. I hope you'll enjoy it. GalacticRoundtable.co. GalacticRoundtable.co. Go there. Enjoy. Email me with your transitions, your plans that you're going to make for New Earth. Thank you for everything you do. Have a wonderful day. Please come back tomorrow. Namaste.